ADM having arrived, I'm going to call the Committee on Taxes to order. Welcome, everyone. Good morning. We have three bills on the agenda for today, and the first bill is House File 2749. Representative Leslegard moves House File 2749 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. And, oh, let's do minutes first before. But we have, you want to withdraw that motion there, Representative Leslegard? Okay, he withdraws that motion, so we'll stay in order here. So we're going to go to the minutes first. We have the minutes for April 2nd, 2019. Anyone care to move those minutes? Representative Carlson moves the April 2nd. Very good. 2019 minutes. Any discussion or thoughts on those minutes? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The April 2nd, 2019 minutes are approved. All right. Now, Representative Leslegard moves House File 2749 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Representative Hewitt, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
And Chair Marquardt and committee members, it's a pleasure and honor to be back in front of you once again. I am here to present House File 2749 and truly am honored to present this bill. The last time a Hewitt was at the Capitol and worked here was my father back after World War II. He was discharged from World War II honorably. However, he was a 100% service-connected disabled veteran due to a mental illness. He served in Guadalcanal at that time. Growing up in a family of with a disabled veteran with a mental illness was quite tough, and so anything we can do or I can do, I definitely want to put my hand out to help them. In this case, what I'm doing today is presenting a bill that would allow us to continue a tax credit for veterans that serve over 20 years or 100% disabled or someone on a pension. Right now, the tax, the adjusted gross income that they are able to exercise this credit sits at $30,000 and is a it sits at a static amount. I am asking in this bill to raise it to $37,500. It does not have an inflator, so that's kind of why we're back in front of you to look at doing this. I'm sorry, it phases out at 37.5. I'm asking to have it raised to 57.5. Members, I stand for your questions at this point.
Very good. Members, any questions? Comments? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I kind of identified with his introductory comments. My father was a World War II vet, had been a prisoner of war held in Germany, and when he was discharged, what we would call today post-traumatic stress syndrome, and we had some real family issues as he struggled with that well on into the 1950s, maybe early 60s. And he was never 100%. If I recall, I think his disability, and they have a measurement, I think it was 80%, if I recall correctly. I think it's a good bill, and it does recognize people who have served that sometimes have long-term disabilities as a result. With my father, I wrote a letter one time, and I referred to it as the longest battle. Meaning his personal battle with post-traumatic stress syndrome. In his day, they called battle fatigue. That was the term that was used, but today it would be post-traumatic stress. You know. So, good bill.
Have you got any other thoughts from committee? Otherwise, is there anyone in the audience who would care to testify for or against House File 2749? Representative Hewitt, thank you so much for bringing this very important bill before the committee to help those who have served and those who are disabled from that service. So very much appreciate that. And any closing comments that you have, Representative Hewitt?
Again, it was an honor to present this bill to you, committee, and to you, Mr. Chair. And I would hopefully that you can put it in your omnibus. Thank you. Chair and Committee.
Thank you very much, Representative Hewitt. Representative Les Lagarde renews his motion to lay over House File 2749 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Next bill on the agenda is House File 2759.
Where's the weak one? It's got regular and strong.
Representative Lesch, good morning. Welcome to your committee. Would you care to move the bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch moves House File 2759 for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill. Thank you. Please proceed.
Chair. In vino veritas. But I haven't drank yet this morning, Mr. Chair. I'm still going to tell the truth. Current law allows up to 2 cases of wine per year to be shipped. We're looking to make some modifications based on the current restrictions and taxes on them. And I have here with me Mr. Carlson, who can speak to the details.
Very good. Welcome. Mr. Carlson, please state your name.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Joel Carlson. I have a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here before you today on behalf of the Minnesota Wine and Spirit Wholesalers Association. The bill before you is a culmination of about a 2-year effort between our association, the MLBA, the Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association, the Beer Wholesalers, the Wine Institute, Federal Express, and labor. I can tell you that there's no opposition to the bill, and we have really worked hard to bring Minnesota's law into the new internet age of direct-to-consumer wine shipping. Minnesota passed a law in 2005 that allowed 2 cases of wine to be shipped to consumers to comply with a Supreme Court decision. And since that time, direct-to-consumer wine shipments have exploded. It's over $3 billion industry right now. It sends over 6 million cases of wine direct-to-consumer. Consumers, and the problems in Minnesota are that when we passed law in 2005, well, we put a limitation on what could be sent, we exempted it from taxation. So all that wine comes into Minnesota at a competitive disadvantage to all of your local liquor stores and liquor retailers. And we feel that's unfair, and this legislation corrects that problem. To give you an idea of the scope of the volume in Minnesota, the direct-to-consumer wine shipment report compared by Ship Compliant, which ships most of the wine for the California wineries, they report that Minnesota sales were $41 million in 2018, representing over 91,000 cases of wine shipped to Minnesotans, with an average bottle price of $37.50, all of which comes in without taxation. On the bill itself, Mr. Chairman, there are 3 sections that directly deal with the tax committee, sections 2, 3, and 4. Section 2 corrects the problem on the gross receipts liquor tax. Section 3 deals with the liquor tax generally. And then I want to point your attention, Section 3, excuse me, I skipped over it. Section 3 deals with the sales tax. And then I want to direct your attention, and this is our problem that we have right now in law. On page 4, at the top of page 4, you will see some language that we are deleting. Minnesota in 2005 said clearly in statute that delivery of a shipment of wine under this section may not be deemed a sale in this state. And so even with Wayfair, which generally allowed taxation on sales through the internet to the destination state, we have a statute that specifically says it's not a sale in this state. And that's why we believe that it's not being subject to tax, and we'd appreciate your support to correct this problem and make sure that it's competitive and fair for our Minnesota retailers. We'd appreciate your support.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you very much, and maybe to Chair Lesch here. We had Mr. Carlson say that because of the tax rates, we're uncompetitive. So do you agree with lowering taxes on direct wine shipments from out of state makes Minnesota wineries uncompetitive?
Representative Lesch.
Well, Mr. Chair, that strikes me as a bit of a softball question. No, I was kidding. I mean, I guess what I would say is we currently have a disparity, okay? And you can say that increasing taxes to what other states are bringing in is going to equalize things in Minnesota, or you could say, you know, lowering burdens on in-state folks would make a difference. But I think that this corrects an inequity, whichever direction you want to go, and that's what we're attempting to do in this bill.
Well,
Chair Davids.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, we're seeing bill after bill after bill here that makes businesses more uncompetitive. Now we have a bill that tries to make our business more competitive. I'm just a little confused here. I mean, corporations are getting pounded. The wealthy are getting pounded. But yet here we have a bill that helps Minnesota wineries become more competitive with lower taxes, in effect. And Chair Lesh, I'm all for your bill.
Any other Representative Carlson?
Chairman, a question for Mr. Carlson. Foreign countries promote purchasing wine. I take National Geographic, and I remember there was an ad, I think it was Italian wine, that to buy this package, and I assumed because they were promoting it as Italian wine that it was coming from Italy. So basically my question is, and especially with the requirement for licensure and so on, how this works with foreign shipments of wine.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, no one has asked me that direct question, but the requirement is that they obtain a license from Minnesota, which is very common across the states, and that it be shipped from their own stock, so they can't bundle it and put it together in a package and send it. I assume that if they are following those requirements, there isn't, that I'm aware of, having read the bill several times, I don't think there's a prohibition against that, assuming they meet the requirements, but I'd be happy to be corrected by staff.
Representative Carlson.
And Mr. Chairman, I suspect an ad through National Geographic, it must be something that makes it legal. But, you know, take, for example, Italy is loaded with small wineries, and what they promote, if you're a tourist there, you know, and you visit a winery, you can have some of that winery's wine shipped to the United States. I'm just not sure how that's regulated when you have so many small operators, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But not anything to belabor. I was just curious if Mr. Carlson had any thoughts on that.
And Mr. Carlson.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I do want to follow up with you, Representative Carlson, because I know one of the requirements for the non-Minnesota winery is that it be licensed in another state. And so that terminology is in there. So I want to follow up on that to make sure that I give you the right answer. And I was going to say in my opening comments, Chair Davids has been a strong supporter of this bill, and he's co-authored it the 2 years we've had it, and I appreciate all of his support.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, on the foreign pieces, I mean, those are all governed by trade deals, you know, whether it be Mexico and NAFTA or any foreign trade deal we have. And those federal treaties would all trump any state law that we may have here. We wouldn't be able to change those. It was being shipped from outside the country.
Before we go to more member questions, is there anyone else in the audience that would care to testify for or against House File 2759? Good morning. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Bagnoli with the law firm of McGrand Shade Carnival. I'm here representing the retailers, the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association and the Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association. And we, too, want to thank Representative Lesh and Representative Davids and Mr. Carlson. We have been involved in this journey, and we view this as, and I think some of you that have been around for a while remember the bricks and mortar. We're the bricks and mortar. I think a couple of years back it was Target and Best Buy that were here talking about tax fairness and making sure that there was equal treatment, and this is just sort of an extension of that conversation where we have, we all pay the excise tax and sales tax in Minnesota, all of the liquor stores and bars do, and this just provides that same level of conformity to people that are buying or selling alcohol in our state to customers directly. So thank you, and we too support the bill.
Thank you. Anyone else from the audience like to testify on House File 2759? See none. Member questions? Anyone? Any further questions? For see none. Representative Lesh, closing comments.
Just thank you. I think it's pretty straightforward. It has broad support, Mr. Chair, and I'd appreciate committee support.
Very good. Representative Lesh renews his motion to lay over House File 2759 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Next bill on the agenda, House File 2557. Representative Gomez. Representative, good morning. Welcome
good morning,
to your
Mr.
committee.
Chair, thank you.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, please.
Representative Gomez moves House File 2557 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So House File 2557 creates a new tier in the rate structure for the estate tax for estates of those dying in 2020 and thereafter. The rate for the new tier is 16.8% and applies to estates over 11.1 million. The top tier rate currently is 16% and applies to taxable estates over 10.1 million. So, we've discussed the estate tax some in our committee before. It is a tax on inherited wealth. Inherited wealth correlates really closely with income. So this is a modest proposal to add a new bracket and offset the exemption, a very generous exemption that applies to estates in Minnesota. There's a $5 million exemption for small business owners or farms and a $2.7 million exemption for all other kinds of properties. So only money above this really generous exemption is subject to the estate tax. It was interesting this morning, it felt like the world was conspiring with me in a certain way, because I woke up and the first thing that I saw when I opened up my Facebook was an article that was actually, it was from last year, but it was about a UN Human Rights Council in 2018 issued this report concluding that with 40 million people living in poverty, the United States is the most unequal developed nation in the world. 40% of the adult population in the United States couldn't cover an unexpected $400 expense. People in our communities are really living right on the edge, and I know a lot of us know that from being out and talking to folks in our neighborhoods. The wealth and income of the bottom 90% of earners and the bottom 99% of earners has fallen precipitously, and it was interesting to see this report because they explicitly call out tax policy in it. In particular, the $1.5 trillion tax cut, which, quote, overwhelmingly benefits the wealthy, and that they go on to say that the tax reform will ensure that the U.S. remains the most unequal society in the developed world. So that's what's true about the United States. This is also true in Minnesota. We've talked about this in a number of different ways, but wages have not even kept up with inflation over the last 30, 40 years. The richest 1% of earners in Minnesota make almost 20% or 20 times that the bottom 99% makes. In 2016, inequality was the worst county for inequality in Minnesota was in Roseau County, where the top 1% of earners have incomes that are 33 times that of the bottom 99%. So this is an issue across our state. It affects urban, rural, suburban, exurban communities. Having families living in poverty in our communities is expensive. When we don't invest in education, healthcare, childcare, preschool, we as a society bear the material costs and the human costs of that disinvestment down the road. The other interesting thing was I opened up my mail and we had this a report from the University of Minnesota that talks about how, you know, for every dollar that we invest in early childhood programs for low-income children, we get a $4 to $9 return on that investment. I think the people of Minnesota are a good investment. you know, income inequality isn't just bad for individual families, for individual workers. It's bad for our economy. You know, research on economic inequality from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, I think those were the guys who developed the offshore list, concluded that, you know, that income inequality hampers economic growth. It decreases per capita income, health and wellness. It decreases disposable income that people have, which is that consumer spending that really powers our economy. You know, Henry Ford had high wages for his workers, not because he was like a nice, generous guy, but because he wanted them to buy his cars. So yeah, when we raise revenue from progressive sources and we invest in the people of Minnesota, we support their efforts to move into the middle class, when we make childcare and healthcare accessible to people, when we provide the education and training that our students and workers need to fully participate in our economy, we all benefit. And like whether you know, as I'm thinking, I know this is like this kind of little tax bill, but as I was thinking about it, it's like our destinies are bound together, right, as a state. And whether you believe that from sort of an ethical or spiritual perspective, or you just have an idea that an economy is a system of relationships, it's we really rise and fall together. And so we have an obligation to make sure that everybody gets to participate in the good life in Minnesota. And this is just a little step getting us closer to that goal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we have three testifiers on the list. If we could go that first, would that be fine to the members? And so I'll take folks who are on the list right now, Mr. Phelan, and then Ms. Cadoon, and then Mr. Hall in that order. So, and good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Good morning. My name is John Phelan. I'm an economist at the Center of the American Experiment, a think tank based in Golden Valley. I'm here to speak in opposition to the bill. Minnesota taxes estates more heavily than most states. It's one of only 14 states plus the District of Columbia to levy an estate tax. Eight of those 14 states and the District of Columbia have a higher exemption. The state's starting rate of estate taxation is higher than any of the other jurisdictions that levy one. Its top rate is 16%. Only the state of Washington has a higher top rate. Incentives do make a difference. So said our former governor, Mark Dayton, when discussing what state governments could do to attract investment. You raise taxes on cigarettes because you think it will incentivize people to stop smoking. Look at wine taxes, which we've just discussed. You have to apply that logic consistently, even in the case of the estate tax. Some individuals will take steps to avoid paying the estate tax, and there are many legal avenues open to those who wish to do this. They can divest assets prior to death by sale or donation. They can leave the state for a jurisdiction with a lower rate or no estate tax at all. And this is all very easy in the US. There is a wealth of evidence that all of these methods are utilized to lower estate tax burdens. In 2013, the Minnesota Society of Certified Public Accountants surveyed their members and found that more than 86% of respondents said clients had asked for advice regarding residency options and moving from Minnesota. 91% said the number of clients asking about moving increased from previous years. Minnesota's estate taxes brought in $183 million in revenue in 2016. That's 0.8% of the state's total income. But this revenue effect has to be measured against the incentive effect of tax revenues lost as people leave Minnesota to avoid the estate tax. Using survey evidence and official data, we at the center last year in a report that we wrote were able to estimate the income tax and sales and excise tax revenue the state of Minnesota loses when people leave to avoid the estate tax. If two-thirds of 55 to 65-year-olds and 80% of those over 65 who left because of state taxes left because of the estate tax, then the tax was a net revenue loser for the state government in every year from 2012-2013 to 2015-2016. Over that period, the estate tax cost Minnesota's government $69 million in lost revenue, $47.3 million in 2015-2016 alone. The 2017 tax bill raised the federal estate tax exemption from $5.6 million to $11.2 million. This has intensified the competition between states and put pressure on those, like Minnesota, with estate taxes at high rates, either to abolish them or, at least, to raise their exemption to the new federal level. This bill goes in totally the wrong direction. It is sometimes said that these taxes are fair because they negatively impact a relatively small number of people. But if we see taxes as a way to fund government activities and not simply as a way to hurt a few people in the name of social engineering, this is not the case. This bill proposes to do nothing at all for the poor. It will raise nobody's wages. It only affects the rich. I'd like to close by citing these wise words. The whole business thing is predicated a lot on the tax laws. It's why we rehearse in Canada and not in the US. A lot of our astute moves have been basically keeping up with the tax laws, where to go, where not to put it, whether to sit on it or not. We left England because we'd be paying 98 cents on the dollar. We left and they lost out. No taxes at all. That sage was Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones.
Thank you very much. Ms. Cadu? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadu, and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're here to state our opposition to Representative Gomez's bill. This would create the new top rate of 16.8%. Minnesota's top rate for the estate tax would be second highest in the nation, just behind Washington, but realize also Washington does not have an income tax. So Minnesota then, obviously, with our combination of our income tax and our estate tax, as Mr. Fallon noted, does have a really strong financial disincentive, frankly, for a lot of our wealthier households to remain in Minnesota. We've heard when we've gone across the state and talked with many tax practitioners, financial planners, and others, the exact data that was Mr. Fallon was telling you, which is really a great uptick in their kind of requests in decision-making that they're seeing on folks that are looking to relocate from Minnesota or have made that decision to relocate from Minnesota. There was a good survey done in 2016 by Twin Cities Business Magazine of about 150 money management, accounting, financial planners that found during the last 2 years, Minnesota lost or began losing an estimated $2.1 billion in taxable income from over 3,000 taxpayers. Those same individuals have $17 billion in median net worth and $31 billion in median gross estate value. And what that survey found is that trend was expected to continue as well. This is really making Minnesota more of a tax outlier in this area. Minnesota is only one of 12 states that still have an estate tax. The trend has been in other states to get rid of it. Most recently, New Jersey and Delaware repealed their estate tax in 2018. Recently, Tennessee, Georgia, Indiana, North Carolina as well. What Delaware found, for example, in a report they did, they found that they called the estate tax a small, volatile source of tax revenue and recommended a repeal based in part on its negative influence on personal income tax revenues. As was mentioned, Minnesota greatly relies on our individual income tax to fund our general fund. 53% of our general fund revenues come from the individual income tax. As mentioned, the estate tax is a very small part of our total general fund revenues, less than 1%. The top 10% of household earners, according to the 2019 tax incidence study, pay 59% of the individual income tax and have 42% of the income. So the reality, when you have a tax like the estate tax that's making this outside kind of influence on our wealthier households, and because of that, if they're making the decision to move in part because of the estate tax, we do agree with Mr. Fallon that said we're probably losing more in revenues than we're gaining from the estate tax. With that, we'd ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hall. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, my name is Max Hall, and I represent the 43,000 members of AFSCME Council 5. We represent state, county, and city employees throughout this state. I want to first start by thanking Representative Gomez for bringing this bill forward and for you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing the bill. Our members believe in excellence in services to the public, dignity in the workplace, and opportunity and prosperity for all working families. And our members believe in a progressive tax system that doesn't place an undue burden on working class people in this state. And so when we look at the tax incident studies that the Department of Revenue have put forward, it consistently says that the Sweet Suits Index is about 1%, meaning that the estate tax is the most progressive tax system that you can levy on taxpayers in this state. So, Mr. Chairman and members, when we put this in context of the 2017 state and federal tax laws, AFSCME Council 5 has the firm position that this creates more progressivity. The Sweets Index is something that's very important to us as an organization, and it should be to all of you who believe in a progressive tax system. But, Mr. Chairman, you know, we've heard that this is a 16.8% tax on estates. If we flip that, obviously inheritors, and this is a point that Representative Gomez made, it's heirs and heiresses who effectively pay this tax, and so they're keeping 83.2% of the wealth that they're inheriting as a result of the death of the taxpayer. And so, Mr. Chairman and members, we believe just fundamentally in a progressive tax system and believe that this bill does significantly help working class people. Another thing that Representative Gomez mentioned is that this is used to fund critical services. I would like to note the fiscal note, which has been briefly mentioned by Representative Gomez. It does levy $1.7 million in 2021 and $4.7 million in the out biennia. That's obviously not a hugely significant number that we've seen in this tax committee, but it is important in terms of the general tax code and its effect on working people. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude, but we hope you can include this in your omnibus tax bill.
Thank you very much. Representative, is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 2557 before we go to members? All right, seeing none, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I've been noticing a couple of these bills here. This bill was introduced on the 18th of March, and yet it does not have a Senate companion. Is there a Senate companion moving through at all in the Senate?
No,
Representative Gomez.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. There is no Senate companion for this bill. No,
Representative Swazinski.
You know, I just don't know how this. If you're potentially going to put this in a bill, like how that would work within the confines of a conference committee. But the idea that it wouldn't even have a Democrat carrying it in the Senate. It's interesting that it was probably not one of the greatest ideas ever hatched. Nothing against this, Mrs. Gomez, but, you know, I think one of the issues we have here is, you know, a lot of your testimony talked a lot about, well...
Remember, Representative Swazinski, keep it to the matter of and not to...
Okay,
member.
Sounds good.
You
sounds good.
Representative Gomez, please just keep it to the
yes,
bill, please.
During some of the testimony, we talked about inequality within society and how, you know, we need to bring folks together. I think, you know, if we want to look at examples of that, I think Venezuela is a perfect example where... You know, there is very little income disqualification. You know, we have very, you know, from the very, very poor to the very, very rich, there's very little difference. Everyone's starving to death. And, you know, if that's our goal, you know, I think this bill is a good step towards that. You know, I when I woke up this morning, I thought I was in the shower and thinking about, you know, the problem with socialism in the United States is really connected to borrowing and the amount of borrowing you're doing. The policy that we have, we're $21 trillion in debt already. We have over $200 trillion of unfunded liabilities laying out before us. So these are promises that we've made as elected officials to the people, said, hey, you know what, we can do this. And the problem we're having is that we think we can have socialism and eat too. And, you know, I think that, you know, we're going down that path really quickly here with income disparity and potentially, as the testifier spoke, we're scaring the investors away from the state, whether it's we're taxing you when you are sick, when you have cancer, we're looking to increase that tax, and now we're when you do finally succumb to cancer, we're going to tax you after you're dead. And, you know, there has to be a point in which there is an action-reaction, and if we're looking to scare folks that have investment that create jobs out of the state, we're doing a great job of it. These bills, you know, are going down that line. And, I don't see how this potentially will lift people up. You know, I do have fear. We had a couple. Anna Odegaard had a bill that she was running around talking about tax time savings. You know, that is a bill that actually may try to increase people's savings. That will, so that they can create a nest egg, so that they can make spending decisions, even no matter how much they make, to try to save dollars, so that they're not one paycheck away from financial ruin. You know, simply going after those that have worked, have invested, who have a potential business that's in our state. You know, the last thing we want to do is create a situation that the only people that can survive in this state from a business perspective or a family are the ones that can pass that cost on or withstand some of the waves that continue to come in from a tax policy on the seashore. You know, I think there is only so much, you know, Mr. Chair, we talk a little about lake places, and, you know, no matter how great your dock is and how much work you put into your shoreline, sooner or later your dock breaks down and your shoreline, the sand is simply washed away. I don't have a lake place, but, you know, I think if we think of tax policy in the same sense, that, you know, we can keep sending waves in of tax policy, of raising taxes, of higher regulation, of sick tax, death tax, whatever it might be, but sooner or later, it doesn't always happen at the same time, but for individual people here and there, we've talked, you know, it's always anecdotal, but, you know, I've got a constituent that left the state, or we had earlier this session, we had a testifier talking about how he opened up his accounting business, not only here in Minnesota, but he's also, because of all of his clients that have left for Florida, has moved another one into Florida. And so if that's our goal, you know, I understand it, and I understand we help, you know, Governor Walz has made, you know, what, I think $18 billion in promises on the campaign trail. If big governments solve it, Venezuela has figured it out, and, you know, it's all cyclical. And, you know, if we kill the goose that lays an egg, pretty soon you have to eat the goose, and that's about what we're doing now. And there we go. So I would say, I would ask maybe, thanks.
Chair Davids.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And, of course, a little history. I work very hard. I think we should abolish the estate tax, because you work your whole life. You earn things for your heirs and heiresses. That'd be your kids, let's say. And then, oh, by the way, you're dead, and we tax you again. That's very unseemly and doesn't seem very Minnesota nice. So I can't figure out how Representative Swinziski woke up this morning in the shower, but that's the way it goes. You know, Mr. Chairman and members, like the great Iron Lady of Great Britain said, socialism works great until you run out of other people's money. This redistribution has to stop. But I found very interesting Mr. Hall's testimony that we like a tax plan that is progressive. I will guarantee you this tax plan will not be progressive. This is a progressive element in the Suits Index. I'll concede that. But I'll be very interested, and I'll ask Mr. Hall when the tax bill comes out if he supports it, because it's going to be extremely regressive. You've got the gas tax, the business tax, the sick tax, the death tax, the wheelage tax, the metro sales tax. And we're worried about somebody, and I'm very concerned because, of course, Greg Davids cares, but whatever percent is $400 away from tragedy, not being able to pay their bills, I'll tell you what, there's more than $400 of increases in this tax bill. There'd be more than $400 of increases in this tax bill. So we you know, pour out the flowery language about how it goes to the children, and it goes to the schools, and it goes to the whatever else. I'll tell you what, I'm concerned about middle-class Minnesotans' pocketbooks when we have all of the hands of government in there pulling their money out. That's what the tax bill is going to look like. We know that. I mean, it's, you know, I was born on a day, but one yesterday. I mean, we can figure this one out. And so I'll be very curious, Mr. Chairman, to see just exactly when the bin, I don't know what ultimately in the tax bill, I can imagine. But when we talk about progressivity, I think the only thing that we've heard here so far is the estate tax being progressive. It is. It is. We're stealing money from dead people. It's the death tax is what we're talking about here. So I've worked very hard over the years to eliminate the estate tax, to increase the amounts so that people can keep more of the money that they have earned and can give to their heirs and heiresses, or AKA sons and daughters. So I can't wait to see the testimony on the tax bill. I haven't seen it yet. I don't know what's in it, but it's going to be very interesting to see how regressive it is. And then now these, I'm taking notes here. These same groups, I'm going to ask them, I'm going to call them up the table here and say, do you support the tax bill that's extremely regressive? It's going to go over $400 in cost to the poor and the middle class. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to have a follow-up question for Mr. Hall, but I think I'll wait until we get to the final tax bill if this is in it.
Okay.
But my question and comments on top of that do refer around to whether or not tax policy has a direct impact in wealth disparity. And, you know, I think it, sometimes it does. And the reason why I say that is because when you have taxes that are regressive, and we have this argument about whether or not they're regressive or not, but I can tell you that, business just can't stay in business if their costs are more than what their revenue is. And taxes are cost. Here, even in this chamber, when we pay taxes back to individuals, it's a cost. And so when taxes go up, that increases their cost. Businesses have two options, and there really is only two, and that is you've got to be able to raise the price or you got to reduce the cost in some other way. And so what happens is if they can't raise the price because it becomes uncompetitive that way, they have to reduce costs in order to make up for the increased taxes. Part of that is not being able to have enough extra money to pay for either raises or benefits or something for the average employee. And then when you add in the regressive taxes, like the 70% gas tax increase that's being promoted, again, it actually takes away revenue from the individual employee. So now not only do they have taxes in other forms in which they're not getting raises they want to, they're now getting more dollars taken out of their pocket, out of disposable dollars. All of a sudden, that continues to make that disparity greater. And so tax policy is a very complex juggling act, and I understand that. You know, we have to do whatever we can to try to keep this equal balance. But I think the idea that because a tax is only for businesses or others in which we say, well, they can absorb the tax, kind of assumes that that cost doesn't get distributed anywhere else. And I think we're misleading ourselves if we believe that that's the case. The reality is that here in Minnesota, our tax policy and the amount of money that we give away from the tax collections, all that money comes from somebody else. Somebody else pays it. Everybody pays it in the state of Minnesota. And same thing is true with most commerce. The consumer pays for everything. So bottom line is, we have to be very careful about how we invest those dollars and about where we take it from. And I think this is one of those areas where it seems like it may be the golden goose, and it may seem like, hey, they aren't going to miss it much. But I will tell you also, as somebody who is an administrator at a church, those extra dollars may also be the dollars that would have gone to a nonprofit organization or something or some other social program that could have benefited from those dollars so that the individual will be able to keep it. So it's not as clean cut as just saying they aren't going to miss it. And I think we have to be very careful about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that last point that was mentioned, there's this persistent myth somehow that if you mess with the tax rates, it's going to impact charity. I just want to remind people that you don't get taxed on charitable contributions. You don't. So it has actually the opposite effect. But one confusion that lingers with me, and maybe it's the Fox News talking points that are cobwebbing up all of our minds here, but when you have someone else's money, that you're getting without having worked for it. And then you're complaining about being taxed on it. I thought that that would run counter to a conservative mentality. Because the last time I checked, you know, we're not technically taxing the dead guy. I grew up understanding you can't take it with you. And maybe, Mr. Chair, I don't know, I've got to ask research if we changed that by constitutional amendment in the last 10 years. But last I checked, you can't take it with you. You can't. So the dead guy's not getting taxed. It's the inheritors who didn't do a thing for a penny of that money. Not a thing. That are getting handed this and then complaining about getting taxed at it. So I would think that that would run contrary to the conservative mentality that you work hard for the money that you get and you get to spend it. When you get a handout from someone else, doesn't matter who it is, it could be a parent, could be grandparent, could be, you know, someone who designated you heir. That I didn't think was conservative mentality. But I would note, Mr. Chair, that the greatest generation, they saw through this facade, and I look at the top tax rates for the estate tax, and the history of the estate tax. It was sitting at 20% from 1926 to 1931 in that decade of great speculative excess that led in 1928 to a bunch of those speculators doing Peter Pans off their balconies in New York City on Wall Street after their dreams came crashing down around us. There was a huge correction on that speculative excess thereafter, and it was called the New Deal. And during the New Deal, we increased that 20% up to a top tax rate from 1935 to the Reagan administration of 70%. It went up to 70%. That was the greatest generation, members. Those were the folks that won World War II for us. Those are the folks that they succeeded during a period of this nation's greatest prosperity, when not just the top estate tax was 70%, but the top income tax rate was somewhere around that ballpark. And we had the greatest period of equality in this nation's history over that. And then we started dropping it. It started going down during the Reagan administration, 65%, 60%, 55%, all the way down 49%, 2007 at 45%. During that period of time between the 70s and now, inequality has increased drastically, back to the point where it exceeds the inequality that this nation experienced during that same decade of speculative excess, the 1920s, that led to that huge crash. So I cannot figure out why we're not learning from history. This estate tax rate needs to be increased far more than what Representative Gomez's bill is suggesting. Because we see, based on the numbers and based on history, the lower tax rates lead to inequality. And these folks that are claiming, hey, give the rich people more money because we're going to do good stuff for everyone else, they're not doing it. We're seeing that they're not doing it. The bill the other day that we had come in, you look at history, you give rich people more money, they're not reinvesting in our country the way that the greatest generation did. And the greatest generation had an incentive to do that. Because of higher tax rates, they made sure that they created jobs on which the tax rate is zero. They made sure that they reinvested in their companies, which did benefit their communities, on which the tax rate was zero. So I think that the numbers just show us that this is absolutely needed, Representative Gomez, number one. And number two, I have no idea why anyone would wave a flag and be proud of the fact that they're getting all this money tax-free that they didn't work a day for. Their rich daddy did, or their rich mommy did, or their rich grandma did.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting that Roseau County has been pointed out the last couple of days in the committee here, and I appreciate the recognition that Roseau County is getting. Representative Gomez, you said that this is a little step. Tell me specifically how this is going to help the folks in Roseau County.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fabian. You know, we've had a lot of discussions in here about what we do with that general fund money, that I think it's 41% of it goes to education. That benefits everybody in the state of Minnesota. Our investments, you know, we hear a lot, in I think, in every committee about the workforce challenges that we're facing. In the jobs committee, we have major investments in helping workers get the skills that they need to participate in the economy as it's changing. So, you know, I mean, education, workforce development, healthcare for people who are struggling and need help with it. Those are ways that everybody in Minnesota, from Roseau to South Minneapolis, is positively impacted by the investments that we make in people's lives. You know, I cited that this study from Harvard that I got in my mailbox this morning. You know, where a dollar invested in low income in early childhood development for a low income baby has a return of $4 to $9, and that analysis can be done on a lot of these investments that we're making, whether it's in higher education, K-12 education, early childhood, or, you know, some of these workforce training programs that people benefit from.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Gomez, can you tell me, of the $1.7 million or the $2.3 million in the out years, how much of that money will actually go to Roseau County?
No, I can't tell you that.
Representative Gomez. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in doing a little bit of math, and I admit that as a school teacher, I wasn't a math teacher, but if I do the math correctly, Representative Gomez, do you know how many people live in Roseau County?
I do not.
Representative Gomez, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's about 15,000 to 16,000 people that live in Roseau County, and if you take the number of 1.7 million and you do the math, and again, staff can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it comes out to about $4 per person.
That's how it works.
If it's divided evenly amongst all the people in the state of Minnesota at 5.6 million. So, you know, I'm not exactly sure how this helps the folks of Roseau County, but I, Representative Lesch, I appreciate what you were saying. And quite frankly, I find it really disappointing that you can make the face. Go ahead. I get it. This is serious. You know, you're attacking family farms and family businesses, and you said that daddy has worked his whole life, and he hands it to his son or his daughter or his son-in-law. Representative Lesch, can you tell me what the average size farm is in Roseau County?
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, no, I can't tell you what the average size farm is in Roseau County. And I will tell you, and we've had this discussion multiple years about, oh, we have to sell off a parcel of our farm in order to pay inheritance tax on this. This is after we have had, and I could ask the same question of you, how many farmers did we have in Minnesota in 1958 versus how many farmers we have now? We could play the same trivia game back and forth. But you and I both know it has shrunk drastically, and farms have ballooned to the point where tillable land, acreage, is impossible to buy. You and I just talked about this in the elevator yesterday. You can't buy farmland. It's the biggest barrier to getting into farming. That's because farms have ballooned. They have gobbled up farms around them, and you can't buy the land because it's not on the market because the prices are too high. So, no, I can't tell you the average size of the farm. I know it's a heck of a lot bigger than it used to be, and I know the availability of farmland for a young person who's looking to get a bank loan to get into farming can't do it because the banker looks at them and says, good luck buying that land. How much are you going to buy, 20 acres with that? It's not going to happen.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that answer as well. But the fact of the matter is that some of my former students are actually farming today, and they're relatively young, and they've been able to put the things together. And a lot of it has to do with being able to pass a family farm from daddy to the son or to the daughter and the son-in-law. And that's what actually makes these things work, is the ability to be able to move that to the next generation. So I just find it really, Mr. Chair, you live in an agriculture community. Yeah, farmland is expensive, and there's a whole bunch of things that have played into that puzzle and to why it is. But the fact of the matter is that the land is being farmed. It's not like the land all of a sudden is just turning into, you know, brush and weeds and so forth. The land is being farmed. And there's a whole host of reasons why it's changing like that. And I'm really troubled by the tone of the conversation that accuses people of not working for what they've accomplished. And when a family makes a decision to try to move from one generation to the next, to somehow infer, not to infer, but to say that they haven't worked a day in their life for that, it's not reality, and it's not true. And people do work hard. And yes, we did have a conversation on the elevator yesterday about land values and the differences between the eastern part of the district that I represent and the western part of the district that I represent. I think that family farms work really hard. And when I talk to my friends and neighbors in Roseau County, the average size farm is going to be around 2,500 acres. They may own all of it. They may not. It might be owned by a son or a daughter-in-law or something like that. But that's the way these businesses are structured. And if $5 million is the ceiling, Representative Gomez, why don't you just get rid of the exemptions altogether?
Representative Gomez?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I mean, that sounds like a rhetorical question. I don't understand what you're, why don't I get rid of the, because that's not what the proposal in front of you is. The proposal in front of you raises the top bracket 0.8%, okay, beyond, what is it, $16 million? Not a dollar is taxed until the threshold of $7.7 million is reached. Okay? This impacts less than 500 taxpayers in Minnesota per year.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But my question is why not just get rid of, why not just tax everything in terms of inheritance? Why go by the tables that you have on here? Why not just, if you get a dollar in inheritance, you get taxed on that?
Well, Representative Fabian, you're referring to the exclusion, that
yes,
first
I,
amount? Oh, okay.
Yes.
So, Representative Gomez, why do you have it like over $10 million and so forth on that fourth or that
highest tier? Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Tier?
And Representative Fabian, again, this bill does not concern the exclusion. I mean, that's all I can tell you. I guess we could ask each other 1,000 questions about why do you do this or not do this, but what's in front of you is a, you know, a top bracket on very large estates.
Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just close by saying that I don't know where it comes from that somehow government has the right to the money, but a family doesn't. I find that troubling. Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe he mentioned my name. I'm wondering if I could speak to that.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I want to point out that this bill is talking about estates over 11.1 million, okay? And there's a farmland exemption in Minnesota for $5 million. Okay, so farmers already get that benefit that's recognized. Okay, and I realize, you know, depending on where you're talking about, price per acre of a farm, if we're talking about, you know, just the land, that's a, in central or west central Minnesota, that's a 1,000-acre farm. Down in southwest Minnesota, you're looking at over $7,000 an acre on average, but, you know, the numbers may have changed in the last year, I don't know. But that's a smaller farm. So, yeah, you're still talking about, if the average farm that you're talking about in your area is 2,500 acres, that gets up over $11 million. And I'm sorry, but if you've got an over $11 million asset, and you're claiming poverty, it just doesn't wash with the average person out there. It doesn't. You're not a simple aw shucks rock kicking farmer. You're a big business owner. If you have that much in assets, and you can swing the economics of it any way you want, but the average person doesn't have access to that. Because we all know that in greater Minnesota, unless you own a farm or you own a business or you happen to be in a population center with a larger employer, you got seasonal work or you've got minimum wage work. That's it. And that's directly related to the decrease of the number of people who have the ability to own their own land. And yes, I get that some people aren't in the position to assume that risk or do that work. I get it. But it's related, and I don't think you can distinguish the fact that it's not related. $11 million is a heck of a lot of money to carry around between generations for folks.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, my name is Hughes.
Representative Fabian.
Again, you know, Representative Lash, I said his name again.
No, that's so. We're good. That's it. We're good. You'll retract that last time.
Yes, I will.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. You know, to somehow now portray that if you're living in rural Minnesota, you either have a farm that's valued at $11 or $12 million or you have nothing, and there's no good jobs out there. They're all minimum wage jobs. Well, folks, I'm here to tell you that we got some really, really, really good jobs in Roseau County, and there's a shortage of workers. And we hear people in the metro area talking about the shortage of jobs and wages are poor and so forth. Come on up to Roseau County. You can start working at some of the businesses up there at $17.25 an hour. And we're looking for folks. Okay? And, you know, this really cuts to the chase for me, the difference between so much of what goes on in St. Paul related to, quote, metro versus rural, which I don't like. The idea that, you know, we're a bunch of rocks and cows out there, it's just really disconcerting to me. I just find it, our folks work so hard, they care so deeply, and people claim to represent the values of my constituents, and I'd be willing to bet you that nobody in this room except for myself and maybe one or two others has actually talked to somebody in Roseau or Kitson County to find out what their values are and what's important to them, whether it's in Roseau or it's on the Iron Range. Members, if we really want one Minnesota, we need to stop attacking rural Minnesota in our rhetoric. It's not going to get us anywhere. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it'd maybe bring us back to the bill. So we have a bill in front of us that raises the brackets over $10.1 million from 13 to 16% and a 0.08% over $11.1 million. It's my understanding that this would affect fewer than 500 people in the state. We talk a lot in taxes about tax cuts. Tax cuts also cost money. So do exemptions, so do exceptions, so do preferential treatment. We talk about a lot of the redistribution of wealth, but we don't talk a lot about the redistribution of the wealth from the poor to the wealthy either. So my question, and this would probably be to nonpartisan staff, and right now we're at $2.4 million exemption for everybody. We have a $5 million exemption for small businesses and farmers, which I understand and think it's a good idea. But the $2.4 million to $2.7 million from 2018 to 2019, how much does that cost? I don't see it on the fiscal runs, and I'm just wondering, because I know that's a cost because it's an exemption or a cut. So the cost between going from $2.4 million and the estate tax that we did in 2018 to $2.7
million. Mr. Clayman, do we have a cost, or I don't know if Ms. Templin or Ms. Schill could answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, I believe Ms. Templin may have information on that. I see here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. The only information that I have at my fingertips right now to answer that question is the cost at the time the bill was enacted when the law was changed, and that goes back to the 2017 session, and I can look that up.
That would be wonderful. Thank you. While you're doing that, I would, Mr. Chair, I would go back to one of the testifiers had mentioned that what we brought in during that time period for those taxed on that was $183 million. So I'm just curious for that $183 million, how much we paid for that. Because a lot of the discussions we've been having in this committee is what we do with our money and investments and where we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck. And I have a feeling that we're going to get the bigger bang for the buck in a lot of other places than where we're spending this cash for those over $11.1 million in estate or $10 million in estates.
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, in the 2017 session when the exclusion was increased to $3 million with a four-year phase-in, the cost in the 18-19 biennium is a revenue reduction of $34.8 million, and the revenue reduction or the estimated revenue reduction in the 2021 biennium with the four-year phase-in with that exclusion is $74.5 million.
So
thank you, Ms. Templin.
Thank you, Ms.
Representative Joaquin.
Now, I married a math teacher for a reason. I'm not that real quick with my figures, but doing back of the napkin math, that's $115.3 million for that $183 million that we get in. And maybe that's not just apples to apples, but I can think of a lot of better ways to spend $115.3 million that will affect everybody all over the state in our education. That's $115.3 million. That's about 10% of what we're talking about raising in at the education bill. That could go even further to talk about the cross-subsidy for our special education that are drowning our school districts. Those school districts that have to give you those educated workers. We could talk about what we could do for housing, workforce housing in all of our counties for that. We're not saying get rid of that. We're just saying for folks making over $11.1 million in estate tax exemption that they should pay 0.08% more. That's all. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I've heard an awful lot of rhetoric today about everything from basically the estate tax is the best thing since sliced bread, basically saying, you know, here we have these people that are getting this money for nothing, and they should pay their fair share. And yet, if I was to say, well, then why don't we tax every estate, including those that are only getting $1,000 or $15,000 from their estate? Why not do that then if it's such a great thing? The challenge with a lot of this rhetoric is that it's a two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. Here on the one hand, you say, well, it's fair because it's funds that they didn't earn. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But this is something that they didn't earn, and so therefore it's free money to them. So what difference does it make? Well, then why do we have the exemption in the low-income side of it? Well, it's because we realize that for a lot of people that is what individuals work for, is to be able to give something to their kids, and they pay taxes on those assets and building those up as well earlier than that. And then we heard rhetoric about, well, they never worked a day for that inheritance. Well, I'll tell you that in farming, oftentimes the heirs that are getting it are those that have worked on that farm all their lives, have never had any money to put in any kind of 401k for themselves. This is their investment for their future, and they've taken minimum wage, maybe just living wage, because they know the importance of the farm and developing it. And now you say, well, they ought to pay their fair share. So let's get back to what the reality is and just deal with farming, and business is very similar. the average farm, in order to make a go, requires about 1,500 acres in order to really deal with the overhead, et cetera. But even if it was 1,000 acres times $5,000. That's your $5 million. A 13% tax on that is $650,000. That's $650,000. And now I farm for 10 years, so I know these things. $650,000 is almost a full year's worth of production cost. That generally farmers have to go to the bank and borrow money to do that, because the farmland is certainly on the books as an asset, but it's not liquid. There's no cash there that you just say, well, I'm going to pull out some of this cash and I'll put it back later. You don't get to do that. So you've got to come up with the money. Most can't. And so then they have to sell off some. Guess what that does to the viability of their farm? It no longer makes it valid, and it no longer makes it worthwhile. Add on top of that, we talk about, well, it's increased value of the farmland, et cetera, but you know what the price of corn, a bushel of corn, was back in during the Depression? It was more than what they're getting today for a bushel of corn. What does that mean? That means that for the average person that is eating, that is buying food at the grocery store, the cost of the food has been kept down because the farmers are producing more and more and keeping food costs down as well. So I just think we have to be very careful about making generalizations that says, well, they're getting this benefit or they're getting this tax reduction because they didn't earn it. They didn't earn a day of their lives towards this. That's not true. That's not true. For a lot of businesses, even that's true for a business as well, when they want to pass it on to those that have been working on it. I will go back to, if we think estate tax is something that is fair and something that we ought to do, then let's take all the exemptions off. We could even reduce the rate and would bring in a whole lot more money than this, if that's what you really want to do. But the other side of it is that I've heard this comment to saying, well, we need to raise these taxes because we need to spend more in this area. We need to spend more in that area. Well, we do that every year. And guess what? No matter how much we spend, it's never enough. It's never enough. We can always do more of this. We can do more of that. And yet we have the OLA report indicating that we're strife with fraud and abuse, but we don't want to deal with that because it's easier just to spend more money. And I'm just saying, look, guys, let's if you want to be fair, let's be fair, but let's not say generalizations like, well, people didn't earn this money, and so therefore it's okay for us to tax it. I just don't think that's right. And I think we need to be very careful about saying something is fair when we do it to one group of people and not to the other. It's just, that doesn't seem fair to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to bring it back to the bill, because it's actually, it's been a good discussion, but the bill is pretty straightforward. The rate for the new tier would be 16.8% and would apply to taxable estates over $11.1 million. So I just want to talk about $11.1 million and having an estate that's $11.1 million. And honestly, I've been troubled by the tone of some of these discussions, too, because there's this expectation, and I know this is a trigger word for people, but the privilege to assume that when a parent or grandparent passes away, that you are going to financially benefit, and that you're going to get stuff. When I'm talking to my constituents in Little Canada, we have four different manufactured home parks in my district. And when I'm talking to those folks, especially in kind of what the reality is for most of the people that live in my district, they have no expectation that anybody else is going to, you know, that even if that $400, whether it's because it was a pothole or because you got some ticket at the park and ride, or, the owner of the manufactured home park decides to jack up the rent, most people don't have that, and they don't have a mom or a dad or a grandparent to cover it. And so, you know, this bill would only impact people who have taxable estates over $11.1 million. And I think the other thing to keep in mind with that is that If you're a family that has an estate of over $11.1 million, I'm going to assume that, and I know this might not always be the case, but if you were planning to pass that on to your family members, you probably also paid for their college. You probably also, you know, maybe help them with the down payment on their first house so they're generating wealth on their own. You know, you have a lot, and your family has probably had a lot for a long time. You know, we know the correlation between, like, high wealth folks is high income as well. So I guess just kind of a reality check in clarifying what this bill actually does, because, like I said, the discussion's been quite broad, but really we're only talking about taxable estates over $11.1 million. And we're talking about unrealized capital gains. And, you know, however you want to string it along, it's still capital gains come from wealth, not from work. You know, indirectly, sure, maybe you had to do some work to get that money in the first place, but you also had to have enough money after paying all your bills and taking care of your family, you know, paying for food and rent and everything, to then have that wealth to invest. And there are a lot of folks, in fact, I think the majority of, you know, at least the folks in my district, don't have money to invest. And so there's that piece of it where it's like having that extra money at the end of the day to invest in something. I mean, yeah, I guess you worked for the wages. You know, you can string it along and make it connect it to work at the beginning. But when we're talking about just straight up inheritance, you know, and to be honest, it's, you know, a lot of folks know my dad passed away last year, and, I inherited his car. Did I expect that I was going to get anything? No. I was really thankful that I had that one thing, you know. And I think that there's just that difference in an expectation that's going to be yours someday, as opposed to folks who are day to day working for their money. And so I just, you know, that's kind of the tone that's troubling to me, is to bring it back to that, because that's a reality, I think, for a lot of folks. So thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Gomez.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think we need to be really careful when we talk about tax policy in isolation. We've had a whole host of bills come forward that really do set the tax tone for those that are the job creators in Minnesota. And this is yet another one, and it's really troubling to me. It's just, we can't talk about this in isolation, just like you can't talk about the impact of Minnesotans in isolation with policy from the state of Minnesota, whether it's tax policy or whether it's energy policy that could skyrocket our energy prices, or whether it's gas taxes that will increase and hurt greater Minnesota tremendously, those that actually commute quite a lot and drive a lot. You know, you can't talk about any of this in isolation. Yesterday I had a phone call from one of the best businesses in my district. And the owner said, we are debating, and we wanted to talk to you before we made our final decision, but we're debating whether or not to expand in St. Cloud or to move to Florida. And they had a big whiteboard, and they had the pros and cons. You know, and tax policy absolutely plays into, are they going to stay in Minnesota and go from 43 jobs to 100 jobs in an industry that everybody in this room really, really wants? They do recycling. They do exactly what everyone in this room wants our society to be doing. They do it well. They make money at it. They employ a lot of people. They do it cleanly. They're one of the star places in Minnesota, the gold star places, to show you how to do it correctly. They have fought through regulation from MPCA and onerous things from them. I've helped them on multiple occasions, talked face-to-face with the commissioner at the time, to say, you don't have the legislative authority, you don't have the legal authority to do what you're doing. And he didn't, and they backed down. They fought through onerous R&D audits, costing them thousands of dollars. They fought through issues with the city. They have fought to stay in Minnesota. They want to be in Minnesota. And tax policy like this and others that we have seen is the tipping point where they say, forget it. We're going to Florida. So no, you cannot look at this in isolation. That's irresponsible. We are legislators, and that is an irresponsible way to look at tax policy. You have to look at it in the total. You absolutely have to. This would make us the second highest in the nation, the second highest only to the state of Washington, which, by the way, has no income tax. Do we really want to be at the top of the nation in nearly every tax category? What do you think that's going to be to the people? What do you think that's going to do to people that literally mortgage their homes to try to start a business? This is what these two men did. They mortgaged their homes and put up as much capital as they could, and they made a really successful business. They created this incredible, responsible, successful business extracting precious things out of our waste stream. And now they called me yesterday and said, we have had it. We don't know if we can handle one more thing here in Minnesota. This session, all we've heard is we're going to raise this, we're going to raise that, raise this, raise that. You're just raising stuff right out of their ability to even stay in Minnesota. They want to go to Florida. So now 43 people won't have a job in my district if they move. 43 families won't have a job. So, no, you absolutely have to look at this in the totality of all of the taxes and what that impact is and what you're saying to the taxpayers of Minnesota, to the employers of Minnesota, to the businesses in Minnesota. Like, you know, I had a meeting a few years back with a really large business just outside my district. They employed 750 people, which is a lot for my area. Sat down with all the owners, the dad and the couple sons and a daughter. The daughter lives in my district. And the son looked across the table at me, and he said, you know, with all of the onerous stuff in Minnesota, who the blank would start a business in Minnesota? Is that really what we want to do here? Is that what we want to tell our business community? Just suck it up or leave? Well, they're going to leave.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think we need to put this in perspective. At most, this is probably going to affect 300 of the wealthiest Minnesotans to die in any one year. And I think we got to make policy based on the broader impact of who this will impact. And I respect that agriculture is a major part of our economy, but the last I saw, there's 30,000 farm owners in the state of Minnesota. That's a pretty small number, and they already have special provisions. Who is mostly going to be affected by this? This is the chief executives who live mostly in the metro, but some apparently might be in Roseau, who are working for large corporations. We just had in the paper the other day about an executive who's making $26 million last year. That's a $500,000 a week. I couldn't imagine how I could even manage investments of a fourth of that, let alone, but I'm sure they've got people who do all that for them. And most of that money is going to go into investments, into stocks, that when they're inherited by their children will not have paid capital gains because they get inherited at the higher basis. So some of this wealth has never been taxed. Last year in 2018, 50 executives, the top paid 50 executives in Minnesota, had compensation of $434 million, an increase of 25% in one year. That's who we're talking about, who has these kind of estates, who, and some of them may be, quote, job generators, but a lot of them weren't. The guy who's making $26 million a year, he runs a utility company. I'm buying my utilities from his company, and I feel like I'm a job generator by doing my part and making sure my house is heat and electricity. And so I think we really need to put this in perspective about who is this. We do a lot of things on myth here. The other myth is that everybody is leaving Minnesota to go to Florida because they don't have an income tax. Well, the reality is almost all of those snowbirds, if their health is seriously threatened, come on back. Maybe not with a heart attack, but if they get cancer, if they get other things, health is your absolute best wealth. And you might go down to somewhere sunny because you don't want to shovel snow for a winter or two and play golf. But the reality is when life starts getting tough and you need someone to stop by and help take care of you, you come back to your lifelong friends, to your children and your grandchildren, and that's who takes you through that final step of life. And I looked up the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research, which HHRQ is known to many of us who work at health policy. And they are a gold standard, credible research organization. And they rated states. And you want to know, Minnesota's in the top 10. Want to know who's in the bottom 10 across our country? Arkansas, California, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Texas. Those states that we keep hearing everybody's leaving to go to, as soon as they start having health problems, they're coming back home to Minnesota. And we've seen this over and over again. And so I think we mostly need to focus on what is fair system of taxation. And for someone who inherits over $11 million, for that estate to pay 0.8% more is a minor contribution to the state economy that helped make them successful. And much of that income, I believe, has never been taxed.
Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's talk about myths, sir, just a little bit. Myth number one, the heirs and heiresses, a.k.a. sons and daughters, didn't work a day for that wealth. Well, how long did the government that's taken this money grab, how much did they work for that money? They didn't work at all for that money. Myth number two, in the 1950s, rates were 90%, but you know what? They invented things called CPAs and tax attorneys, and their effective rate was 42%. It's not what the rate is, it's what do you pay? What's the rate today? 37% state, federal, and local taxes. So in the 1950s, when the rate was 90%, the top 1%ers paid 42%. The most recent data says that today it's 37%. So it's very, very, very close. We can't pretend that the great society was built on taxing the rich because it wasn't. It was not. Now, we're going down a very dangerous path here, Mr. Chairman and members. How many times have we heard in the last 2 days, well, it only affects 300 people. Well, it only affects 500 people. Yesterday, it only affects 2,600 people. Yesterday, it only affects 1,200 people. The infamous Russell B. Long, a legislator from the great state of Louisiana, said, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that fellow behind the tree. Well, members, soon we're all going to be behind the tree. Because when the money runs out, they're coming after everybody. Don't think for a second they won't. So, you know, the myth that especially I think Representative Petersburg was right on. I mean, a lot of times these sons and daughters work their whole life knowing that someday they will inherit the farm and see some of the fruits that are later. But again, members, to think that the comment didn't work for a day, my question to you is how much did the government work for those funds? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And members, I do appreciate the conversation. And, you know, I agree with what Representative O'Neill says, that we can't take these things in isolation. And, you know, in the last few days, as I've heard, we've looked at bills, you know, and as far as fairness and leveling the playing field. And, you know, rural Minnesota and farmers have been mentioned today quite a bit also. And we're looking at a tax bill ultimately that will work for everyone, everywhere. And we also know that we have a deficit into the next biennium. And, you know, when you look at rural Minnesota and farmers, if we don't do anything, they fall behind. And Representative Loeffler put out We know this for sure. In the property tax division report, there's going to be $30 million new dollars in the local government aid. 65% of those funds go out to rural Minnesota, many small communities that need that. We know in that bill that the ag credit on school building bonds is up from 40% to 70%. That's going to be $30 million of property tax relief to farmers that not only helps solve an untenable position, but helps equalize the playing field on school referendums. But just those two things that I've mentioned there that will greatly benefit rural Minnesota, into the next biennium where you have this deficit, it's $60 million for local government aid and $80 million for the ag credit. That's $140 million there. You start putting in broadband that farmers use, and very important, child care, huge housing issues, huge out in rural Minnesota. If we don't do anything, if we don't invest and find resources into the biennium, rural Minnesota falls behind. Farmers fall even further behind. And so that's kind of the question and the balance we have. And so as we look for those resources in making sure we get a tax bill that helps everyone, everywhere, you know, there's going to be tough decisions and priorities that are going to have to be reached. And so granted, this bill is, as far as dollar amounts, is pretty minute. But I think the discussion we had today kind of lends itself to what you're going to see here as we talk next week, as we put the entire tax bill together. So Representative Gomez, you've got maybe 30 seconds for closing comments.
Yeah, thank you so much for the good conversation. You know, I just would end where I began. We're the most unequal country in the developed world. We have to really look at the role that inherited wealth plays in reinforcing the wealth and income inequality that is detrimental to our economy, that hampers productivity, that hampers growth. This would really impact very few people. A farm, even one that was a 1,000-acre farm in the example, would be exempt from all of these taxes. So I'm, again, thankful for the conversation.
Thank you very much, Representative Gomez. Reducer, motion to delay over House File 2557 for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill. Thank you very much. One quick announcement, members, is there will be two bills added to the agenda that are not on there yet for tomorrow. One is 1851, Representative David's bill, a licensed petroleum distributor, requirements to furnish bonds for payments, removed. And then there is a clone of House File 1652, and that's Representative Joachim. Is that going to be your bill? And that has to do with Metropolitan Area Transit Bonding Authority. Is that correct? So those two bills will be added. Just so you'll see those later today, but they're not quite up. We're trying to finish up bills. So, members, with that, thanks for the discussion. We are adjourned.